I want to say really two words of introduction to this psalm and this shiur, then to read it together, and then to walk through it and both read it carefully and think about the larger issues that it raises. The two things that I want to say by way of introduction, one is very brief and one is a slight bit longer. The first is that I think one of the things that happens when you start spending a lot of time with Tanakh is that you realize, perhaps to your surprise, how much of Tanakh is preoccupied with the problem of, wait, there are certain things this text tells me to believe, and that in theory I do believe, and that in practice seem to be refuted by experience sometimes, if not often. That is to say, there is a gap and sometimes even a chasm between what faith declares about the world and what we experience. I would even say it's been an interesting experience for me in the years that I've spent teaching Tanakh. A lot of modern Jews are pretty convinced that that problem is uniquely modern. And what has been interesting to me to try to open up for people is that problem is as old as the text itself. The text itself already has a problem with the text, right? Which I think is just really, really striking. I once had a student, full-time student at Hadar, this very curmudgeonly British woman who used to say, modern people are so full of themselves, we even think all of our problems are uniquely modern. And I actually found that that was like an interesting lens for understanding that Tanakh has the problem with Tanakh that many of us have. So that's sort of piece number one here. You know, there is a term that Protestant Bible scholars use. I'm not completely convinced that it's perfect, but it's helpful for some people. Walter Brueggemann, probably one of the most influential Protestant Bible scholars in the world, talks about how Tanakh contains both a testimony and a counter-testimony. And I think that many modern Jews have not been taught about the counter-testimony. You know, when I went to yeshiva, there was no counter-testimony because it was not the text that we ever studied, right? And this is a really interesting text that arguably is a kind of counter-testimony. I'm still not convinced that testimony is quite the right language, but I think the point he's making, I trust, is clear, okay? That's introduction number one. Introduction number two, more concretely, and this is by coincidence, if you're on the Hadar mailing list, I'm going to try to do a version of this larger question as Hadar's pre-Pesach lecture this year, but I want to say a version of it here because it will really, it's a central lens for thinking about this text. When you think about the role of memories of the Exodus in Tanakh, so it's really two things that go on. I'm going to say something that might be obvious, but that's important to say for a minute. One is the remembrance of the Exodus, but the other is the reenactment of the Exodus, right? It is not just about remembering that something happened. It is about making the experience actual and present such that I have just re-experienced it. To sort of give away what I want to talk about a little bit in that lecture, the most powerful example of this, I think, in Tehillim is Psalm 115, Betzeit Yisrael Mimitzrayim. You all know this from Hallel. The JPS, I think, totally fumbles the translation, right? You have this text, right? And it says, Hayam ra'av ayanos, right? The sea saw and fled. And then a minute later, we say Malecha hayam kitanus, which JPS totally fumbles and says, what is it that bothers you, O sea, that you fled? That, I believe, is totally wrong. The translation of that is in the present tense. What is it that is happening to you now that you are fleeing? Meaning, what happens is we start out telling a story, and then all of a sudden, we are in the story happening right now. God is not the one who once turned flint into well, but the one who does that actively. Okay? Now, that means, you'll see where I'm going with this in a second, that the Exodus in Tanakh is a source of hope, not just because it's a distant memory, but because it is a constantly re-experienced present. It is ritually enacted. Many of you have heard me talk about a lot over the years about how I think one of the problems that ails contemporary Judaism is that Jews do not have any ritual imagination. Like, we daven words, but we don't really like, oh, this morning I went to shul and I left Egypt when I said Az Yashir. It's just not the way most Jews talk. In America, Catholics have ritual imagination. Protestants are committed to having no ritual imagination. No, really, that's actually part of what Protestantism is, right? Jews have ended up like Protestants. And that's an interesting discussion as to why that is. But that's in theory what goes on. But then there's the other side. And this is the piece that I kind of am trying to draw out a lot in thinking that I've been doing lately, which is that the Exodus also has another side. And it's what I would call the double edge of Exodus. And that is, so sometimes I remember the Exodus, I even make it real, and I feel like I was just liberated. Other times, I remember the Exodus, I make it liturgically real, and that makes my present suffering even worse, because why not now? If then, then why not now? This text that I'm bringing to you today, Psalm 87, Tehillim Ayin Zayin, I think is one of the classic kind of, wait a minute, God. And one of the most amazing moments in all of Tanakh, I think this psalm says, God, have you forgotten how to be God? Which is like as chutzpahdik a question as you could possibly imagine, right? Did you forget the job description? Psalm 77 is a really interesting example, I think, of that, okay? And what I want to invite you to do as we read this text is to keep in mind how is the Exodus playing at different moments as this prayer unfolds? How is it functioning both as a source of hope and as a source of intensified despair? Because what I think you'll find in this text is that both edges, if you will, both sides of the knife are playing in the same text, which is one of the things that makes this text, I think, so interesting. And this is a psalm that most Jews don't know because it's not part of the Siddur, right? So it's like, unless you happen to be obsessed with Tehillim, you don't really kind of see this. So Psalm 44, which is probably one of the most famous laments in Tanakh. Psalm 44 begins with a memory of how God was in the past, which was wonderful, and then moves to a present in which God is, as it were, falling down on the job. And it's the angriest parak in Tanakh, you could say. This text is parallel to that, except for one thing. It's presented in the opposite order. This text begins with a lament about the present, and then moves to an extended recollection of the past, and then doesn't do one thing you would expect, which is somehow connect them. And so as we'll see at the very end, even modern scholars debate, what are you supposed to be left with as a student or a davener of this text? Are you supposed to feel like, oh, I remembered the past and somehow that brought me comfort and now I'm okay? Or is it, I remembered the past, but you know what? The present still hurts, and I don't know what I'm supposed to do with the gap between the present and the past, right? So this is a mirror of Psalm 44. Again, just to be clear, then you had the more logical progression of past great, present awful. Here you have present awful, past great, have a nice day. And that's very, very confusing, and I suspect that it is meant to be, just to sort of give away my cards, if you will. I think this text is actually meant to be, at least at part, an expression of that bewilderment that I began with, right? Like, wait, how am I supposed to live with these two different God experiences that I have? If you will, the memory and the reality, okay? Okay, let's sort of dive in and focus for a minute. I want to just bring to your attention that there's another gap here that is worth thinking about and that modern scholars of Tehillim are constantly kind of at a loss about, which is that it would seem that the first section of this Tehillah, the first verses Bet to Yud Aleph, are really about the suffering of an individual, right? Koli el Elohim ve'etzaka, I am crying out to God. And then the response is a totally national memory. And so the question is, how does the suffering of an individual relate to, then, an appeal to, a memory of the national experience of God? Now, you could say a few things, right? You could say that an individual who is suffering seeks solace in memories of how God was with the people. But you could also complain, I don't know why that would work. When I'm in the hospital and feeling abandoned, remembering the Exodus might not be the thing that most helps me. I'm not saying that might not be true for everyone, but that's the dilemma here. So that's one common interpretive path is to say, look, a Jewish individual an Israelite individual, is suffering, and he calls upon what Jews call upon in thinking about God as a redeemer, which is a national experience of God heeding those who were in pain. And then again, as I say, there are those who are skeptical. And then there's the more common view among Bible scholars, at least, which is that the psalmist in this text is a kind of model sufferer who is expressing his individual experience of a crisis that is more national. You have this a lot in Psalms where people assume that it is the king who is the individual speaking on behalf of the suffering of the people. And if that's what this is, then the appeal to Yetziat Mitzrayim actually fits better, right? Because the personal suffering is, right, someone can feel personal pain about, let's say I write a psalm about the state of America. On one level, that might be my personal suffering. On another level, I'm an individual lamenting something that is national. I think that is the more common view these days about how these two pieces relate to each other. Does that make sense? Is that more or less clear? Okay. And in this particular shiur, I'm not going to spend almost any time on classical parshanut, but if you look at classical parshanim, they tend to want to interpret this as many psalms of lament as about exile. That's a sort of common move in terms of what might be going on here. To belabor the point for a minute, and then we're going to kind of do this more verse by verse, about the unity of this text, to finish what I was saying before in response to Neil. First of all, as I mentioned, the same number of words in both parts. Second of all, the centrality of the verb zachar, to remember, in both halves. Third of all, which is almost a dead giveaway in psalms like this, the name Elohim appears 7 times over the course of the whole psalm. I feel like that is often how psalmists leave a signature, to say, it's not 2 texts. I'm trying to do something interesting. You also will have 2 references to my voice in the first part that I think are responded to 2 references to God's voice in the second part, meaning it seems to me very likely that this is actually 1 text. And as I think I already mentioned this, but I think that one thing that is just really worth keeping in mind is the sheer both audacity and suffering that would lead one to ask God, have you forgotten how to do your job? That feels like almost more aggressive than you're not doing your job, right? I mean, imagine that you're sitting with your parent and you don't just say, you're a bad parent. You say, have you forgotten what it would mean to be a good parent? There's a kind of hostility and rage in that, I think, and a devastation that I think is just worth acknowledging. I mean, I will just say, I find Pasuk Yud here, Hashachach Hanot El, to be one of the, like, as it were, the low points of biblical experience. Have you forgotten how to be compassionate? Right? It's like, that's not something you say when you've been disappointed once. Right? Does that make sense? What I'm trying to get at? It's not something you say, like, oh, someone hurt, you're like, oh, like you have a fight. Everyone in this room has marriages, if you have them, that are perfect, I know. But, you know, you have like a little boy. He's like, oh, have you forgotten how to be a spouse? It's like, you know, that's not your first line of argument, right? That's like after when things have gone bad. I want to draw that out because I think, in other words, that's how you see the depth of the pain in this text. I apologize if that's not a great example. But, you know, the point that I'm saying is this feels like very far down a path of disappointment to say something like this. Have you forgotten how to be God? I mean, that's like really pretty intense. And, you know, we could talk about this or not, but I think one of the things that's so interesting about laments in general, I know, like, over the years, I've taught a bunch of these at RYI, and some of you have studied many of these with me over the years, either here or online, but the range of what Psalms of Lament imagine one can say to God in relationship is so much wider than my 7th grade Chumash teacher ever would have allowed. I think it's really important to sort of see the range of what the relational space opens up into is just so much vaster, which I think is why if you study Tanakh in yeshiva, you never hear about these texts, let alone learn them, let alone daven them, because the range of what's sayable in relationship has been made more constricted. Does that make sense? And then the flip of that, of course, is you really have to be in relationship with someone to say this kind of thing to them. Which is why I often say to people, right, to daven laments, the one thing you can't really be is a non-believer. right? It doesn't make sense. You can't say to God, have you forgotten how to be God if you're an atheist? You can say to God, have you forgotten how to be God if you're in love with God and you feel hurt? Very different. I think one of the ways that this psalm expresses its pain and disappointment is that almost none of it is addressed to God in the second person, and almost all of it in the first part is actually in the third person. The person has been, I'm going to try this on for size for a minute, so hurt that he can no longer bring himself to speak to God, can only speak of God. Right? That is really, meaning, I think, if I am not mistaken, in this whole first section, only Pasuk A is a direct address of God. Everything else is, I lie in my bed all night, I'm lonely, this stinks, he stinks, and I can't sleep because of you. Right? That's it. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like, to belabor this point, if you can remember a bad relationship you've been in, when you want to argue a point, and then you're like, what's the point? Right? I'm going to say something, like, you're not listening. I can't prove that that's what's going on here, but it is really striking. Jonathan, you know, kind of jumped the gun here in a really helpful way, I think, which is like, he can't even really speak to God anymore. He doesn't do it in this text, right? And I think that's a step of almost traumatization. Like, I'm not going to speak to you, right? And when I do speak to you, what I'm going to say is, I can't speak to you. Nif'amti v'lo adaber. I'm so overwrought that I can't even speak. Which is a paradoxical thing to say, of course, right? Yidutun. Who was Yidutun? According to Divrei Amim, Aleph, Perek Tet Zayin, Yidutun was a famous musician in the temple. So, Lamanatzeach al Yidutun, for the conductor, probably sung by Yidutun, Le'asaf. Asaf was a Levi who established a guild of Levite singers. This is Perek Chafhei of Divrei Yamim Aleph, Psalm 73 to 83 are the Psalms of Asaf, okay? You should try not to get totally derailed by the headings of Psalms. First of all, it isn't clear that they're original to the Psalms. And second of all, they're very hard. And they don't give you much by way of content. By the way, also, you probably all know this, but I'll just say this. If you are someone who is starting to use Christian Bible commentaries, always keep in mind that Christians are, quote-unquote, often one pasuk off in their numbering because Christians don't count the heading as a verse number. That is, so pasuk bet for a Jew will be pasuk aleph for a Christian. I remember, to my embarrassment, when I first started reading academic Bible scholarship, I was like, Protestant Bible scholars are so sloppy. They always quote the wrong verse. And then I was like, okay, I don't actually know what I'm talking about. Okay, so, okay. And by the way, some headings of Psalms are basically the first interpretive moves. One very obvious example of this is a psalm that we daven in traditional davening every day, Mizmor Shir Chanukat HaBayit LeDavid, followed by a psalm about recovering from illness. That is a very odd heading for a psalm about recovering from illness, right? It really makes almost no sense until you realize that for many psalms, exile is interpreted as illness. Ani Hashem Rofecha, right? I am the Lord, your doctor. So somebody is trying to take a psalm about illness and interpret illness as a metaphor for exile. But the point is, like, be careful about the headings. All right, that said, let's actually read the psalm, beginning with verse 2, okay? So, Koli el Elohim ve'etzaka, right? My voice to God, and I cry out. And then Koli el Elohim repeated, to state the obvious, the repetition is a way of conveying urgency, right? My voice to God, and I cried out. My voice to God, and please may he listen to me. And I gave you in the packet sources 1 to 3 just to sort of make the point that se'aka is used elsewhere. It is very common, a term to suggest grave distress. Se'aka is more than tefillah. It is, oh my God, I am really in trouble. Okay? Now, I'm just going to push through a few psukim here and then stop. Pasuk Gibel, Yadi, is just very odd. JPS translates with my hand uplifted, and Josh helpfully pointed out my favorite meaning of Heb, uncertain. Some scholars want to amend Yadi to Eini, based on the verb used, nigra. The notion that yadi nigra does not make a lot of sense. And if you look at source 4 in the packet, in Lamentations chapter 3, eini nigra velo tidmeh, my eye poured out and didn't stop, right? So it isn't really clear what this means. The NIV translation, at night I stretched out my untiring hands. If you want to keep the word yadi, you have to say something like, my arms have been stretched out to you and I won't put them down, something like that. They refuse to tire, something like that. But it's a little bit of an odd locution. And then always, when you're reading a biblical text and the locution in the Hebrew is odd, you have to decide, is that a reason to amend it and assume it's wrong, or is that deliberate to bring the reader up short and give you an image that you didn't expect, right? That's an interpretive choice that you have. There's no ironclad method there, right? To state the obvious, nighttime here is presumably the time when pain and trouble seem most, you know, intense. Rashi equates nighttime here and elsewhere with exile. So I cried to God during the day, and even at night, my hands were stretched out. Me'anahi nachem nafshi. My being refuses to be comforted. And then it seems like verse 4 is a kind of, I'm not getting answered and it's getting worse. Eskira Elohim v'emaya. I think of God and now I just start moaning. I'm not even screaming anymore. I'm just groaning. Asicha v'titate fruchi sela. I keep talking and my whole spirit collapses on me. Now just notice here, Eskira Elohim. Here, the word zachar is used for the first time to refer to his own experiences. And then later, the same verb will be used to remember the Exodus, which will, again, invite that question about what is the relationship between those two things. Now, at the end of this pasuk, we have the word sela, which I alluded to before. Nobody knows what sela means, and if they tell you they do, you should not believe them. As a rule, most academic types think that sela is some kind of musicological term, something like cue the instruments at a moment of disjuncture in the flow of the text, like there's going to be a shift in the mood. I think for most contemporary Jews, the notion that there is musicological instruction in the middle of a psalm is just weird because most of us don't use psalms that way. But that is probably what it means. The Septuagint thinks sela is a point to an interlude. Radak famously thinks that sela comes from the Hebrew salal, to recite with a raised voice. If you want to go into obscure land, really, some modern scholars think sela is clearly rashei tevot for something. Other modern scholars say, oh, really? Show me a case where rashei tevot is even a thing in biblical Hebrew. I can give you one example, I think. Jeremiah chapter 7, Heichal Hashem, Hema, which many scholars think Hema, which makes no sense, is Hamakom Hazeh. Yeah, your guess is as good as mine. But we don't know what Sela means, but you should see it as a cue that something's going to shift now, seemingly. And then this shift seems to be, as Jonathan kind of hinted to us in a way, he's going to start talking to God, and he's going to talk about how he can't sleep because he's in almost inexpressible distress. His eyelids are open, which can have two meanings. Rashi thinks it means he's watching, waiting for redemption. Feels to me a little more organic to imagine that he can't sleep because he's so miserable, that this is insomnia. And then we're going to hear about long nights of being kind of miserable and agitated. And then in verse 6, he's going to introduce the theme that will occupy us the rest of the way, which is the contrast between his present experience and what he's been taught to expect from Israel's past. This is impossible, and it's not supposed to be this way. Okay? I want to read just a couple more verses and stop for comments and questions, and then move on. Yamim Mikedem, I assume, is basically a direct reference to the Exodus. Chishavti yamim mikedem, Shnot Olamim. I would like to propose that sometimes when the Exodus is referred to as a long time ago, that has an edge in Tehillim of not just, oh, this was the paradigmatic event, but also, that was a long time ago, God. You don't get to bank on that thing forever and ever, right? You know, I think in Psalm, even in Psalm 44, our fathers told us how you redeemed them way back when, right? It's like, yeah, you were a good father, you know, when I was 2, and now I'm 34, and it's been a long time. Or we had a good marriage when we got married, but like, you know, it's been a long time. So I think that there is quite possibly an edge there. And then you will see, I just want to make sure you see this, JPS, which is very committed to idiomatic translation of English, and therefore not to capturing literary devices, you miss completely in the JPS translation that the verbs in verse 7 are the same verbs as in verse 4. Eskira and Asicha, right? JPS doesn't care about that. It's not what it's doing. Staying with verse 7 for a minute, Neginati, I just want to say you can read this in two ways. JPS translates their jibes. You can also translate Neginati as my song, in which case the memory would be of, I remember when I sang of God's greatness. I remember when I thought you were a loyal, faithful redeemer. You can really read Neginati here, I think, as either one of those two possibilities. I think it's more common among translators to take it to mean my song than to take it to be their jibes. I think the JPS is probably in the minority here. And then V'chapes Ruchi is really very hard. JPS says, my spirit inquires. Quite possible. Some modern scholars, this feels very contemporary and not convincing to me. I search my own self. First of all, that would need to be V'achapes Ruchi. But I think it's just hard, okay? And then verses 8 to 10, you could say, are the heart of this perek. And they raise the question of the basic character of who is this God we are worshiping? And does this God still love us? Verses 9 and 10, you can say, are a kind of commentary on Exodus 34, 6 and 7. To remind you, Exodus 34, 6 and 7 is Hashem, Hashem, El Rachum, Bachanun, right? They take up and question each aspect of this and thus kind of represent, you would say, like a direct, you might even say an assault on the core of biblical faith. God, who is known for God's faithfulness, for God's keeping of God's promises, for God's mercifulness, is not acting in such a way that suggests that this is who God is. And so the psalmist asks, has God's nature changed? This is like the ultimate kill a medieval philosopher before he even gets out of bed. Has God's nature changed, right? Right? The ultimate, there's no less Maimonidean thought than that, right? Has God's nature changed? You used to be merciful, but now you're indifferent, right? Now, by the way, you sometimes see really traditional believing scholars. Because I'm in a Jewish room, I'll pick on evangelicals rather than art scroll types, right? You'll see the way they try to soften this, right? Listen to this for a minute. This is a guy named Willem van Gemeron. A pretty good scholar, but like a very conservative evangelical. This is his comment on these psukim. In asking these questions and in expressing his doubts, the heart of the psalmist comes to rest, for he knows that the God of Abraham cannot deny himself and cut himself off from his own people. In questions, there lies hope. Please forgive me, but this is a terrible reading of these verses. Because what it ends up doing is, like, basically, like, you constantly domesticate the most painful moments in Tehillim, which I understand completely why you do, but I don't see anything in this psukim to suggest that this is supposed to reassure him. If anything, the agony builds, right? And I'll share with you something beautiful here. Commenting on these verses, Walter Brueggemann says, both answers, yes and no, are available, depending on whether the focus is on Israel's narrative faith, in which case the answer is no, or the speaker's described experience, in which case the answer is yes. That, I think, is a much more powerful formulation of what is going on here. And that's part of what I mean when I talk about the chasm between faith and experience, right? The God of the Exodus has not forgotten how to be merciful. The God of my life, that God forgot a long time ago. That's what you have here, I think, in a very powerful way. Or Brueggemann calls this also the no of tradition and the yes of experience. Keep in mind, the no is no, God has not changed. It can be confusing, but that's okay. And then he says in Brueggemann's comment, the nighttime rumination surely leaves the psalmist bewildered and exhausted. That is very different from Van Gemeron, who's like, oh yeah, you just asked the question and you know the answer is, of course, God is here. That's just not, I think, very persuasive. And notice something else also about this psalm that just amplifies this point. In a lot of Tehillim, there is an enemy. And the problem is God is not doing anything to save the psalmist from his enemy. Here, there's no enemy but God, kivyachol. Meaning, right, there is no enemy. It's just me and God, and you're not doing your job, right? And I think that that intensifies this in a very deep way. Now, 77:8, Halaolamim yiznach Hashem. Turn to source 6 in your packet for a minute. Because it seems to me this is an example of where Prakim and Tanakh talk to each other. Ki lo yiznach le'olam Adonai. Right? I mean, they don't get more explicit than this. This is a little bit like Psalm 44 saying, Ura lama tishan Hashem, and you're hearing in the back of your mind, Hine lo yanum v'lo yishan shomer Yisrael. Right here, you have Echa saying, right, of course God would never abandon forever. And then you have Psalm 77 that says, except that maybe God does. And this is where, you know, this is a great example of what I sometimes try to talk about, that the meaning of Psalms and verses in Tanakh often takes place not within verses, but between them, right? The way they talk to each other. This psalm is enraged by that pasuk in Echa, I think. Okay, I just want to go, again, I just want to finish this unit and then we'll stop for observations and questions. Then we'll talk about the second part. 77:9, ha'afas, or ha'afes lanetzach chasdo. You should probably hear in the back of your mind, ki le'olam chasdo, right? God's faithfulness goes on forever, except when it doesn't, right? This is like an earth-shattering question to ask, just to be clear. It seems like, if I'm understanding this verse correctly, what I would want to say that's going on in this verse is, the psalmist is not in doubt that God's chesed has failed him. The question is whether it will go on failing him forever. That God has failed him is beyond question. That's what he's saying. The question is, will that change? That's already a tragic question. It's like, I know you were unfaithful to me. The question is whether you're going to go on doing that. Well, there's already like a total brokenness in the premise, right? Ki lo olam chasdo is already not true. Now the question is not whether ki lo olam chasdo, but rather, is it ki lo olam afes chasdo? Will God's lack of chesed go on forever? And then quickly at the end of verse 9, nobody knows how to translate Gamar Omer Lador Vador. JPS has, as we heard, will his promise be unfulfilled for all time? Maybe you can say, will his word fail for all time? I think word might be different than promise. Promise means one thing, but God's word disappearing might mean that God has stopped speaking to me altogether, that God has broken the relational bond that took place between us, right? I know this is hard for a lot of us to relate to because most of us don't live with a God who talks to us, but in Tehillim, that's a kind of common assumption. It may be, as source 7 in your packet, just playing with this possibility that what this means is that it's no longer prophets prophesying salvation, right? I don't know what this means exactly. And then verse 10, im kafatz ba'af rachamav. Notice af and rachamim standing right next to each other there, rage and mercy. God was supposed to be, according to Exodus 34, slow to anger, even when there was good reason for it. Here, God seems to jump to anger, and even when there's not clearly good reason for it. Okay, now, I want to say something about verse 11, and then I really am going to finally pause. I said this verse is impossible. This verse is impossible for two reasons. One, we don't know how to translate chaloti, and two, we don't know what shnot means. Okay? So let me try to say that in as clear English as I can. Chaloti, JPS translates, it is my fault, but then says, meaning of heeb uncertain. Alter, by the way, is similar, it is my failing. I think that chaloti could just as easily be, it is my grief, it is my pain, like from the word lachalot, to become ill, right? The Common English Bible, which is a very good, more recent Protestant Bible translation, it is my misfortune, I thought, that the strong hand of the Most High is different now. You could even translate, if you want to push the point, it makes me ill. Not in that sort of raging way, but it makes me, it saps me of my strength to think that the right hand of the Most High has changed. Shnot Yamin Elyon, the right hand has changed. One problem is, what does chaloti mean? Does it mean, as JPS suggests, it is my fault? Or does it mean something more like, it is my grief or my suffering? But then also, just to give you a headache, Shnot Yamin Elyon, which I think probably does mean the changing of the right hand of God, could also mean something like the years when the Most High stretched out his hand. Shnot as in the plural smichut of Shana. That's what makes this pasuk untranslatable. It feels to me like it makes most sense in context for this to be, and this is where I break down in grief. God really has changed. Right? But the Hebrew here is very, very hard. So the idea that God has changed is shocking and disturbing, even for Tanakh, not just for Rambam. You can look in your packet for just one quick second. And with this, we end part one at sources 8 and 9. Ani Hashem lo shaniti, says Malachi. Right? I am God, I don't change. Right? Or then Tehillim, v'chasdi lo afir me'amo, I will never take away my steadfast love from you. The notion that God has changed, you don't actually need to be a Maimonidean to be scandalized by that. So I think this feels to me like it's the moment when the psalm hits bottom. And this is what broke me. God is not the same God anymore. I mean, that is really hard. And then we get to this last section. And the question is, what do we do with this? And I want to just sort of mention a few interpretive possibilities, kind of writ large, and then we can go more slowly. One is that recalling the Exodus and the times when Israel celebrated God's redemption almost takes the place of a petition. You have here a hymn in place of a petition. Follow what I mean by that? Right? The hymn is basically like, God, return to your job. There's a Bible scholar named James Mays who talks about how the second part of this is thinking the past into the present. I would prefer to say, at the risk of sounding very much like a Protestant Bible scholar, this is hymning the past into the present, not thinking the past into the present, right? It is really about evoking in poetry and song who God once was, and thereby doing two things, I think. One, restoring confidence in the person praying that God is still like this, and two, inviting God to actually be like this again. Those are not the same thing. I want to make sure that it's clear. Those are two separate things, right? They're related, of course, but one is that I hymn God into the present as a way of making the present bearable for me, and the other is I hymn God into the present and thereby remind God of what God is supposed to do and be. Now, there is a very different way of reading this, which is far less optimistic and actually makes this even more painful, right? Oh, the present is terrible. Let me remember the past. Oh, the present now feels worse. When I think about how in love we used to be, and then I think about how you're no longer here, I am more lonely than ever. That's not a crazy reading of what's going on here. People follow what I'm saying, right? I think, what I sort of tried to offer at the outset is, and I can't prove this, is that the refusal of the author of this text to sort of tell us how to tie this together is part of the decision of the author of this text. That's not sloppiness. That's an invitation to live with complexity and elusiveness. Right? Oh, well, what is the relationship between Yetziat Mitzrayim is alive and no, it's not? How do I live with that? How am I supposed to hold that? And again, the fact that it's not clear is evidenced by the fact that you have modern scholars who say, oh, well, by the end of this psalm, he feels much better because the Exodus is alive for him. And then you have others who say, no. The author of this text made a decision never to actually try to tie this back, right? There's no seams here. And that's why you could say what you said in your Kfirah de comment that started us off, right? You're like, oh, it's two texts. That's because nobody tied these two parts together. And so you and I are forced to be like, well, wait, how do we live with the gap between the past memory and the present suffering? How do we live with that? I don't think this psalm is invested in solving that. It's invested in creating some kind of liturgical piece around it that leaves us to do something with it. One of the things that's so odd about this psalm, and one of the reasons I wanted to bring it, is the psalm actually, you know, some psalms, as I said, have one side of Exodus, and then the other psalms have the negative edge of Exodus. This individual psalm has both edges of Exodus. At the beginning, it's, I remember it then, and it stinks, makes it stink now. And then part two seems to be like, I remember it then, and maybe it's more livable now, unless Evan is right. But, right? But, and what I propose that I really, I say this very tentatively, that in the first part, the problem is that all he's doing is remembering Exodus. And the second part, he's making Exodus present for himself again. And I'll show you that in a second, where the verbs become present tense verbs. And if that's the case, then there's a kind of, I don't mean this literally, but there's a kind of argument here. Remembering Exodus makes things worse. Making Exodus present makes things better. And then this is a brief on behalf of religious imagination. Do people follow what I just said? I'm not trying to sell you on it yet. But like, in other words, this is not, as so often, either the Exodus makes me feel hope or the Exodus makes me feel despair. This is both. So what happens? And again, I think the difference is we move from memory to reenactment, right? In the second half of this psalm, he's standing at the sea again. And then it's like, oh, yeah, oh, you really are God. You are the God of Yetziat Mitzrayim. Again, that's a very hard sell for a contemporary Jewish crowd. Really? What am I supposed to do? But I think that is actually, let's actually do this because we're going to run out of time. So first of all, just notice quickly that you have in verses 12 and 13, a whole series of nouns that I think are allusions to Exodus, which will then be evoked more clearly in verses 14 and on. That is, ma'alalei, pil'echa, pa'olecha, alilotecha. These are all allusions to what God did in the past. Verse 12, just as he voices his complaint in verses 4 and 7, eskor, now he voices his praise. And in verse 12, the second part, not coincidentally, to go back to Jonathan's comment from a long time ago, a shift to second person, which is not coincidental. Some kind of relationship between him and God is being restored. And that's what I'm saying, that maybe what differentiates the second half of the psalm from the first is that here, the Exodus is brought to life and made to be experienced as in the present. And now, at the risk of overreading, Ga'alta bizroa amecha, right? That is the response to the right hand of God has changed. No, I can still feel your arm. I know zroa and yamin are not the same word, so I'm stretching a little bit. But in other words, I'm feeling it again. I'm experiencing it as present. In the opening verses of this psalm, the Exodus is only a memory and a distant one at that. Recall the psalmist's words, my thoughts turn to years long past. In the face of ongoing torment, memories that seem remote and inaccessible only sharpen hurt. But in the later verses of the psalm, the Exodus is brought to life and made present. Recounting God's deliverance, the psalmist declares, you are the God who works wonders. Note not you were the God who worked wonders. Now, through extended recitation and evocation, memories of Exodus no longer seem quite as distant. In ancient Israel, it is this type of memory, past made present, then experienced as now, that gives hope. That's the argument I want to propose. Okay? Now, again, this requires immense liturgical imagination and also a theology that many contemporary readers may not share. I'm not denying that. I'm here only trying to read this psalm. I'm not trying to make this psalm work for contemporary Jews on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Read myself. I'm not trying to do that. I'm just trying to understand how this psalm is not a stira mine uve, if you will, right? How is this psalm not a self-contradiction? And what I'm proposing is that actually the two types of memory are different in the two parts. We won't do this now because we're running out of time and I want to hear what people have to say about this. I'll just sort of say here to state the obvious that in verses 17 to 21, the sea of the Exodus is associated with the waters of chaos defeated at creation, right? They are the chaotic waters. This is an association that you find a lot. Paro, as Yechezkel says, is the sea monster, right? There's a lot of that in these texts. I just want to bring your attention to one amazing, amazing phrase. And that is the end of verse 20. Okay? Your way is through the sea. And then this unbelievably evocative phrase, v'ikvotecha lo noda'u. Your tracks could not be seen. The waters saw what God was doing, but people didn't. I think, guys, this is a total, if I'm right, this is one of the most amazing moments of biblical theology because it says, you know, even then, when you were the God who split seas and redeemed us, it wasn't obvious that it was you. This feels like an Upper West Side Jew again, all of a sudden, right? Right? Like, v'ikvotecha lo noda'u. Yeah, you could have just seen it as a thunderstorm. It wasn't obvious that it was you. Even then, it wasn't obvious that it was you. I mean, that's an amazing moment. I have to say, this moment is so amazing to me that I'm not convinced that it's pshat, because it's too contemporary, right? But it's like an amazing, or John Goldingen's translation, but your steps were not acknowledged, right? It was you, but we couldn't be sure because we couldn't see that it was you. That flies in the face of everything you've been taught to think about how Exodus religion worked. Everyone who saw, right? Everyone saw that it was God, except the psalmist is not sure. And one of the things I always talk about with people who are like, well, I would believe in God if God only made Godself known. And I'm like, have you read the book of Exodus? I know we often feel like the problem is that God does not make Godself known. That is not the claim of a biblical text. The claim of a biblical text is God made Godself known, and that lasted for about 72 hours. Pyrotechnics are not the path to faith. Really, I mean, I think that's actually really an interesting claim about Exodus, right? It's actually quite subtle, right? Like, and it really flies in the face of what a lot of us think. I mean, I know I certainly feel a lot of, well, if God only made Godself more obvious, if God weren't hidden, I would be a believer more percentage of the time. That is not what Sefer Shmot seems to think, right? It's really not. It's really quite striking. But I just, this phrase is so wonderfully evocative. V'ikvotecha lo noda'u. It wasn't obvious. There's two possible readings there. One is, it wasn't obvious, and the other is, it wasn't acknowledged. Those are not the same. I wanted to sort of have you just sort of see that, because it opens this up in a whole different way, right? This is like, oh God, you were totally there. And even then, not so clear. I have to say the last pasuk of this psalm a little bit mystifies me in a sense, mystifies is a strong word, not mystified in the sense that it's bewildering, but I'm not sure what work that's doing. Is it, I don't only miss you, I miss leaders worthy of you? What is it? It's not, right? It's not so clear. But, and by the way, does that affect your reading of where he ends up? Because now that we're here, you have that question again. Those who want to say, oh, it's better now. And those who want to say, it's not better. It's just memory. I'm trying to split the difference a little by saying it is somewhat better. because the memory, the texture of memory is different. What I don't know and don't pretend to know is how that's supposed to affect me as a 21st century reader of this text as a religious person. I was just trying to play Bible scholar, right? Like, I was just trying to figure out, like, how do I make this text tell a story that's coherent as opposed to, like, just bizarre? Like, oh, I remember the Exodus and it's miserable. So then I remember the Exodus and I'm better. This is bizarre, right? Something more interesting has to be going on than that. And it feels like the kinds of memory are different. That's what I'm proposing. What is just so kind of intensely moving to me and challenging to me about this text is that it feels like it just takes the, how do we live with a memory of redemption in a present that really hurts? And says, like, let me offer you, like, every possible version of that in one text, and now good luck to you as you try to pray your way through this. There's just something I think so moving about this. This text is so hard. Like, more than almost any psalm I've spent time with, every time I read this, I have, like, a totally different take on, like, what's actually happening here. And that's led me to this place, which may be a cop-out, I'm honestly not sure, of, like, maybe that's part of the point. Maybe the text is about, in part, acknowledging the hardness of this, about how do I hold a past that feels at odds with my present? And not just a past, but a past experience of God that feels at odds with my present experience of God or my present lack of experience of God. I'm not even sure how to say that. And that's what I thought we could at least kind of begin to draw out together in this time. Thank you all.